Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan US Center's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In June 2024, I spoke to Adia Harvey Wingfield, the Mary Tylston Hemenway Professor of Arts and Sciences and Vice Dean for Faculty Development and Diversity at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Wingfield's research examines how and why racial and gender inequality persists in professional occupations. Professor Wingfield is the recipient of multiple awards, including the 2013 Richard A. Lester Award from Princeton University for her book, No More Invisible Man, Race and Gender in Men's Work, the 2018 Public Understanding of Sociology Award from the American Sociological Association, and the 2019 C. Wright Mills Award from the Society for the Study of Social Problems for her book, Flatlining, Race, Work, and Healthcare in the New Economy. We spoke about Professor Wingfield's new book, Gray Areas, How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. Our discussion also covered U.S. labor activism and the role U.S. federal and state governments have in addressing racial inequalities in the workplace. Well, thank you so much for joining The Ballpark this afternoon. It's great to be able to speak to you.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. I'd just like to start out and just to ask you to please give our listeners just a brief overview of your research and work.
Sure. Most of my research focuses on racial and gender inequality in professions. And so that's led me to look at Black workers in a variety of different jobs, from healthcare to engineering to the legal profession, and a number of jobs in those areas to try to understand why we continue to see so much racial inequality in our workplaces.
So your latest book is Gray Areas, How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. Could you just please give our listeners a brief overview of the book and its main themes and takeaways? Thank you.
Yes, sure. So the idea behind Gray Areas really builds on what I was just saying about my general overall interest in racial inequality in the workplace. I was really curious by what seemed to me to be a bit of a paradox, that in the United States, at least, we're 60 plus years past this passage of the Civil Rights Act. And we are in a society where there's a lot of attention to and discussion around diversity. Most employees said that they want to work at places that have some attention to diversity. It's really common for companies to at least have some language about that on their websites and in their planning and so forth. But we also know that if we take a bit of a closer look, our workplaces actually are not really very diverse. The data show that Black workers are still experiencing wage gaps that don't go away with more education. They are underrepresented in leadership across pretty much all industries. They are still likely to face substantial hiring discrimination. And so I wanted to try to understand how can both of those things be true? How do we live in this society where legal discrimination has been outlawed, where we're very pro-diversity in terms of language, but we're still really not seeing those gains manifested when it comes to the workforce? And so after doing interviews and looking at the data, the argument that I make in Gray Areas is that the reason why we see this inequality is perpetuating isn't because people are explicitly, openly discriminating. And it's not because there's a shortage of qualified, interested Black workers. It has a lot more to do with how we are working and with the social, cultural, and emotional parts of our, relational parts of our work, whatever referred to as the gray areas, are the areas where racial inequality persists in our workplaces, and that's why we have not made more progress.
For your book, you spent 10 years interviewing over 200 Black workers in a variety of different roles. Can you talk about the obstacles to success that you found they faced in the workplace and where these obstacles came from? Thank you.
Sure. So what's interesting about the respondents that I spoke to is that they span a variety of different jobs and industries. So in the book, there's Amalia, who is a journalist, but there's also Alex, who is doing gig work, driving for Uber Eats. There's Brian, who's a film producer. These are very disparate jobs in very different fields. But what I found for many Black workers is that the areas where they experience a lot of challenges have to do with hiring, getting access to jobs, and being fully integrated into the networks that allow people to have information about what jobs are available, to move into those jobs fairly seamlessly. They face challenges when it comes to the organizational culture in many workplaces, because often organizational cultures are built on this premise of colorblindness, this idea that we don't want to talk about racial inequality. We don't want to identify where that might be present. It's considered gauche or inappropriate to have too much of a focus on racial inequality in many workplaces. And in particular, when it comes to this question of hiring, that so much of how we move ahead and advance in workplaces is very heavily driven by relationships with supervisors and people who are in leadership positions. And in many cases, Black workers are the ones who are least likely to have those types of close relationships. And that can present itself in difficulty moving into leadership roles. Not, again, not because people lack the qualifications, the skills, the motivation, the interests, but they don't have the relationships that enable one to move into, to be considered as someone who fits the role for moving into a managerial position, or someone who seems like a managerial type or a leader or what have you. So what I found from these interviews is that for Black workers, these areas of the social parts of work, the cultural parts of work, the relational parts of work, again, the gray areas, not the things that are core to how they're doing their jobs, but these more social parts are where we see inequalities perpetuating, because they have to do with the parts of work that are unregulated. They are often kind of off the books, if you will. They're usually not clearly specified in our job contracts or our particulars around the type of work that we should be doing. And that leaves room for racial inequality to persist.
In the United States, my understanding is that in many states, worker protections are not as great as they are in Europe, in parts of Europe and in the UK, for example. Did these lack of protections contribute to what you found when you were researching your book?
Yeah, that is a great point. And it's certainly very true. In the U.S., I will say we had a long way to go to get to a place where we have the type of robust worker protections on the books that need to, that evidence shows really make a difference in terms of workers' ability to have more stability, security, and productivity, and so forth. And so what I find for Black workers is that the lack of these protections can make jobs that already feel a little bit precarious seem even more so, right? So we know, for example, in many places in the United States, people are employed in right-to-work states where they can be fired with cause, they can be fired without cause. There's just really not a lot of security and job stability facing many, many workers. And this is true for people who are in professional jobs, for people who are in non-professional jobs. But we also know that for Black workers, there's often this perception grounded in reality that they face more, that they face closer scrutiny than their white colleagues. They are more likely to be observed. They are more likely to be watched for mistakes. They are more likely to be expected to make mistakes, and they are less likely to have room to bounce back if and when mistakes are made. So you already have this culture where there's this precarity and this uncertainty around whether you're able to even maintain a job, right? And that what that does in general is it creates an environment where workers in the U.S. often overwork. They don't necessarily have boundaries where they can shut off. They feel this implicit pressure just to kind of keep going, keep working harder, to not take vacations, to not take leave when they need to, just to keep going because they know that they're easily replaceable. For Black workers, that is exacerbated because there is also this added layer of understanding that not only are jobs in general very precarious, their jobs in particular as Black workers are also shrouded by this sense that they are likely to make a mistake, that they are always being carefully watched, that they're always being carefully scrutinized, and that there's really not a lot of room for error. And this came up among some of the workers that I spoke to, but it's present among a lot of other studies that document how these worker protections for the lack of worker protections, I should say, for Black workers have a racial component to them as well.
So what sort of reforms might be helpful in this sort of area to support Black workers so that they're less precarious? Obviously, it's not the whole piece. There seems there's lots of aspects of sort of workplace culture, as you're saying. But could reforms be helpful, and what sort of reforms would be helpful?
Yeah, I think reforms will be very helpful. And interestingly, I think reforms that work towards providing more stability and more solid ground for workers writ large would have a lot to do with improving the conditions for Black workers. So I'll give you one example. In California, in the U.S. right now, there's discussion about kind of a law that will create for workers kind of what they're calling kind of a right to unplug. And the idea is that workers face kind of a cutoff point. And if employers contact workers after, say, 5 p.m. at the close of business, then that employer can be fined. And the idea is that workers should have the right just to not be at work all the time, to step back and to take some time for themselves, family, whatever they want to do that's not work related, right? So the idea behind that is to provide more of the space, but so that workers have a bit of a cushion. That type of legislation, I don't believe it has been concretely passed yet, but one of the things that I expect could happen if it were to be passed were that it would reinforce this idea that workers have the right to unplug. They have the right not to work all the time, and not doing so should not and could not be held against them. I think for Black workers, that could have real added benefits because it could potentially give them the cover that they need, not to feel as if they need to work all the time because they're always trying to compensate for the stereotypes that they are poor workers, that they are lazy, that they are not competent and suitable and so forth. Now, something like that in isolation obviously isn't going to solve all these problems. And like you mentioned, in the United States, we have a long way to go. We are, to my endless frustration, one of the few advanced Western democracies that does not provide paid parental leave or paid sick leave, a fact that disgusts me and makes me upset when I'm here in the UK, where I know that there's a month of leave that workers are guaranteed, no matter how long that they've been at the job, no matter what their position at the job is. Reforms like that, I think, could really go a long way in shifting the regulatory environment from one that's very pro-employer, but often at the expense of the workers who constitute the economy. And I think making a shift towards that type of more balanced environment so that workers do have rights and that we are not expected just to work constantly all the time would have benefits for everybody, but it would have particular benefits for Black workers who are, again, generally more precarious than workers of other races in the labor market.
In April of 2023, you wrote for the U.S. Senator's USAP blog on how resurgent labor activism must address workplace racial inequality. What developments around labor activism have you seen occurring since then? And is there a chance that these developments might have a long-lasting impact?
That is a great question. In the U.S., we are in a really interesting place right now because we are starting to see a lot of backlash from the gains that had been made in the post-civil rights era, and I would say in the early 2000s as well, when we started to see more and more companies pushing towards this focus on diversity and talking more openly about what a benefit diversity is for their outcomes and for their productivity and for their workforces and so forth. We are now in a place where there's a lot of pushback to that, and there are a lot of efforts from think tanks and from certain activists who want to move in a direction of redressing and moving away from the efforts that many companies and businesses have made towards diversity. So I think where we now are is a place where we may begin to see kind of this upswing in labor activism taking into consideration the need for more attention to diversity and the need to really stand up to and fight back against the forces that are pushing for minimal or no attention to diversity in companies and in businesses and other social spaces, in education, for example. So I think there's the opportunity for the renewed labor activism that we are seeing in the U.S., this focus on this rise in workers who are interested in unionizing and collective action and collective bargaining, to attend to the fact that not only do we want to make sure that we are collectively working for workers' rights at large, we want to also make sure that we are including what that means for Black workers, that we are taking into consideration anti-discrimination protections, that we are voting for leaders who are interested in funding the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission rather than defunding it, that we are interested in putting together platforms that make sure that the types of issues that specifically affect underrepresented workers, Black workers specifically, are on the page of those who are trying to reconstruct our workplaces to make them more equitable environments and not ones where these types of inequalities just are baked into the systems and the structures that we have.
Thank you. And are there any specific industries or organizations? I know Amazon was in the news, or workers' cooperatives organizing around Amazon, for example. Are there any specific organizations, institutions that you would, our listeners should be interested as sort of an illustrative example?
I'm not sure I would say illustrative examples, but I would say there are ones to watch. Amazon is one of the really important and interesting ones to watch because they have unexpectedly had some success at union organizing among the workers. And of course, there are efforts to try to curtail that and shut that down from management and leaders. But I think Amazon is going to be an important one to watch just because there have been some successes, even though those successes have not come easily, and those successes could easily be walked back. Starbucks is another really important one to keep an eye on. There have been real efforts from workers who are Starbucks employees to try to move towards unionization. there has been very explicit denunciation from Starbucks leadership. Even past leaders have been very critical of the idea of moving towards unionization. But again, because these are major global businesses, because of the reach that they have, because of the breadth that they have, I think it's really important for us to keep an eye on them and see what direction those are going to go in. Because I think more successes from places like Amazon, or from workers at places like Amazon and like Starbucks, more successes from United Auto Workers. I work in education, more successes among people who are unionizing in educational industries could really have some interesting implications for where this type of labor activism goes or does not go.
So my next question, we've touched on this a little bit, we're talking about places like California, but I'd be interested to know a bit more about what role or influence the U.S. federal, especially in state governments, have had in addressing racial inequalities in the workplace in recent years. Thank you.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, too. I would say the federal government in recent years in the U.S., we've whipsawed a bit, a bit, as you know, if you follow U.S. policy. So we're in the middle of a Biden administration, which is very different from where we were under a Trump administration, which wanted to disseminate federal guidelines that made it illegal for workers and organizations to discuss things like diversity, to talk about concepts like systemic racism, to talk about and have diversity trainings, right? So I think the contrast between those two administrations has shown us that federal government policy and federal government directions can vary quite widely depending on who is in leadership in those roles. We can have a federal government where, depending on who is leading that federal government, there's more receptivity to collective bargaining and union activism and moving towards efforts that address racial discrimination. Or we can have a different federal government where there's a clampdown around even talking about these types of issues, right? So I think we see examples of ways that federal government initiatives can be very divergent, even in the span of 8 years. And I think in the U.S., at least, because our state level politics vary so much, there are similarities there, but those similarities are very different at the state level, right? In the sense that who's in leadership matters a lot, but perhaps even more so, what matters is whether you live in what we consider a red state or a blue state. A place like California taking efforts to try to make sure that workers have time to unplug is not likely to see those efforts replicated in a state like Missouri, where I where I live, right? Where you don't see too many state level policies or legislations that are enacted to try to make sure that the focus is on workers and their rights, much less racial discrimination in the workplace. So it's highly variable, and it's very much in flux, I would say, in the U.S., and it's very much dictated at the state level by which state you're in, and at the federal level, very much dictated by who happens to be in office and what type of priorities they have.
Thank you. And just thinking about the state level, you mentioned Missouri, for example, as a state that protections were not nearly as good or for Black workers, for workers in general, as, say, California. Does that mean in that case, if Missouri is likely to be a Republican-led state for the foreseeable future, that it is then down to the federal government to make policy so that the entirety of the U.S. benefits from these worker protections? Is that kind of, right, is that the way out?
I think it could potentially be, right? Because we know in the U.S., federal laws are supposed to trump state laws. And I say supposed just because we've also seen examples in the U.S. of state-level politicians attempting to find ways to circumvent federal laws, right? But the expectation and the rules are supposed to be that at the federal level, those policies do supersede what happens at the state level. So were we to see federal level policies that were very robust and muscular in terms of providing protections for workers, for addressing anti-discrimination, I think that would be an important starting point. I think, though, that we'd still face a lot of legal action, fights, and pushback at the state level because there's so much entrenched investment in not following the lead of federal government policies and interventions with which red states don't agree or find compelling.
How do we get to a place where, for organizations, diversity is no longer a buzzword?
That's an interesting question also. I think that One of the important steps to making sure that for organizations, they're doing this work seriously rather than just kind of paying lip service to it, which is what I think you're implying with the buzzword argument, is to reiterate, I'm a social scientist. And so for me, I tend to always go back to the data and the research and to think about what that says. And what we know from the data and the research is that organizations that have more diversity among their workforce have higher performance, they have more productivity, they have better returns. These are facts, right? These aren't just things that I'm saying because they sound good. This is stuff that I'm saying based on the data and the research. So I like to think that for organizations, when they are confronted with this data, when they are confronted with that information, it becomes clear that from an organizational standpoint, it is to your benefit in the short and the long term to think about how some of the existing practices that you may have relied on may actually be working to your detriment, and how you can move from those practices to evidence-based, data-based solutions that actually will help to increase and improve productivity, right? And I think another part of that has to do with making sure that companies have more of a way to access knowledge and way to access information that is out there, right? I mean, again, I mentioned my field is sociology. I understand everyone doesn't have time to read American Sociological Review every month when it comes out, right? That just may not be a thing that other people are doing outside of this field. But I think that it highlights how important it is for there to be more of a connection between researchers and academics and people who are working in this space, having a connection with people who are in organizations, so that people who are leading companies who might not have time to read American Journal of Sociology can connect with academics who do, who can say, look, this is what the research shows us. It shows us that if you're mandating diversity trainings, that is not going to work. If you are putting together diversity task forces pulled from people in your organization, that's shown to have more evidence, right? That's not a thing that I think is necessarily intuitive, but it is something that with better communication between researchers and organizational leaders, there's more of an opportunity for those leaders to build on the data and the research to do what works and not just do what other companies are doing or just say diversity is important, but then not go anywhere past that.
Thank you so much. I think that's a really important point about bringing in that kind of academic research into the organization. And I just want to ask a follow-up question, because I think you've talked a bit about kind of organizational culture and that kind of thing. Do you think that, we can't necessarily say all organizations are the same. I guess what I want to ask is, will they listen? Will the top C-suite management folks will they listen to the research? But what are you found? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's a great question too, and one that I think about a lot. So I'm going to speculate a little bit here. My speculation would be that I think just like in many other cases, you'd find some variability within organizations, right? And I do wonder if we're talking about smaller scale organizations, the expectations for how to diversify and the ability to do what works to diversify may be a little bit challenging if we're talking about a small business with, 10 employees or what have you. There may be some challenges to the types of strategies that we know are shown to work for larger for-profit companies. But to your question about whether companies writ large will actually listen, I think we have some evidence of people who are leaders in the space that are really powerful and significant, who, again, understand what the research shows, understand that diversity is beneficial, and who are on record saying that, right? If you look at recent statements from Mark Cuban, owner of the Dallas Mavericks and a very well-known American businessman, he's on record saying that he's very committed to continuing to support DEI because of the fact that it matters and it helps him to be a better business owner and it helps to improve his business. Jamie Dimon, CEO on Wall Street, I think has defined, I'm going to misquote him, but he's defined himself as an unwoke, red-blooded capitalist who's very committed to that position. And he also recognizes that investments in DEI matter in order to get the best business outcomes. So these aren't nobodies, right? These aren't people who are unfamiliar to many people who are in the business world. These are people who are really highly visible, very highly platformed, who, again, are aware of the data and the research that show that this really matters and it benefits them and it benefits their companies. So what I actually think is that there are more people who are in leadership roles who will listen than perhaps we think. I think the challenge is to encourage or empower or whatever it takes to get more of those types of business leaders to follow the lead of people like Mark Cuban and Jamie Dimon. I don't think Mark Cuban and Jamie Dimon are the only ones, but I think that were we to see more vocal full-throated support along the lines of what we have seen from them, I think that would be really impactful.
This question kind of comes out of what we've just been talking about. How can people, and I think by people, I mean consumers and workers, really keep the pressure on companies to address racial disparities and create more equitable opportunities for Black workers?
Yeah, that's a great question too. I mean, I think there are ways for, I hesitate a little bit about this question about consumers, right? Because I grew up in an era where we talked about, you know, we're not going to support this company because this company is doing a thing we don't like. So instead, we'll take our business and support elsewhere. I don't know how much that model affects or is useful for the types of issues that we're talking about here, right? But what I do think is that for people who are workers, for people who are employed by companies, for people who are who have connections to these companies as workers, as contractors, or what have you, I think perhaps those people have a lot more power than they might realize. And this is a thing that I do talk about in gray areas. I talk about things that everyday workers can do to try to address the gray areas in their workplace, right? If you are a worker at a company and diversity is something that matters to you and the prospects of more employment opportunities for Black workers matters to you, then I think there's an opportunity to refer people for jobs in that company, right? We know from the research that upwards of, I think, 70 to 75% of us today find jobs through connections that we already have, right? But we also know that for Black workers, they are less likely to be able to use their networks as effectively. Even though they try, they're less likely to be referred. And when they are referred, that organizations are less likely to follow up on those referrals. So to me, that suggests that if you are a person in a company and you want to think about what you can do to address these issues of diversity, make sure that your social network includes Black workers so that you can say, hey, I know such and such, and I know we're looking for somebody to start in this entry-level position. This person that I know would be great for this. And make sure that that's something that you're doing consistently, referring people for these types of jobs so that they have a way into the door. If we're talking about the organizational culture in many workplaces, which often is colorblind and often shies away from these discussions of race and racial inequality, then what happens on the everyday level is that when these types of issues come up, then people may often be uncomfortable. They may not know what to say. They may fear saying the wrong thing. But even just offering some support for doing diversity work in companies can go a long way, right? Being at the table and saying, you know, it's important that we get this right and this does matter. And this is something that we need to be doing as a company. Saying that openly makes a difference. If we're talking about how people advance into leadership roles, again, we know that that isn't always just based on the person who is the best for the job getting that job. Often it has a lot more to do with relationships with managers, with leaders. So make it a point to be a mentor, make it a point to be a sponsor, make it a point to make sure that as you're doing that, you're taking into consideration Black workers and other underrepresented workers who may not necessarily have access to people who are in sponsorship roles and facilitating their transitions into leadership that way. So I think these are all examples of things that people who are everyday workers can do in their companies that are perhaps a little bit more effective than just saying, you know, I'm not going to purchase from X company because their numbers are low. I think there's room to think about what we can do as workers and employers to change the companies where we are most connected.
And just going back to the political angle, as people who vote and people who can campaign, what should people do in terms of their state representation and federal representation?
Yeah, that's a key one, right? Because as you mentioned, so much of what happens at the policy level has to do with our elected officials and our elected representation. So obviously, I'm going to say to vote because that that matters. But I think also think about which candidates you are voting for are most likely to support workplaces that are more likely to put more support behind workers. And there are often some pretty stark differences that we see between which elected officials want to support policies that are shown to support workers and which ones aren't really interested in doing that. The particulars, again, are going to vary from state to state. They're going to vary from place to place. But most elected officials have some sort of way to check what it is that they support. And if they are not supporting things like improving minimum wage, paid sick leave, paid childcare leave, things like that, then that can tell you what their thoughts are about the types of workplace issues that affect all of us.
Just to finish off, I just want to give you the opportunity, if you have any upcoming research or projects that you'd like to promote, or just anything you think our listeners should know about. Thank you.
I think the only thing I would say is that I touch on, I think, pretty much all of these in more detail in gray areas. And one of the things that I liked about writing that was it gave me the opportunity to use worker stories to highlight how these issues really had an impact on them in particular. Right. So we've talked about things that happen at the policy level and what impact that has on workers. And I'm thinking about Alex, who I mentioned before, who was driving for Uber Eats. And one of the interesting things that I've observed happening with platform work in the gig economy is that there's this tension between this rise in gig work and many companies not wanting to classify gig workers as employers, right? They are contractors. And that's a really important distinction because as contractors, it means that they are not entitled to certain benefits, disability, retirement, health insurance, things like that. None of those things that employers have to pay into are required of people who are doing gig work. So for someone like Alex, who I describe in the book, Alex goes into this gig work because she kind of needs it as a stopgap measure. She gets laid off at the start of the pandemic. She's got to do something to pay her bills. Gig work is easy enough. She starts driving for Uber Eats. And interestingly, when I asked her if she experienced any racial or gender discrimination during that type of work, she said, no, you know, I drop off food. It's pretty straightforward, which might make us think, you know, well, hey, here's something to consider. Gig economy work might allow these workers to sidestep the types of discriminatory patterns that are present in other places. But if we think about the bigger economic picture of what someone like Alex is experiencing, again, as an independent contractor, the company is not providing for any retirement benefits. They are not providing any leave. They are not providing any disability benefits. She's simply on her own doing this work where she doesn't have coworkers against whom she can measure herself. That doesn't necessarily mean she's not experiencing discrimination. It means that the types of ways in which discrimination becomes embedded into gig work become digitized and less visible, not that they disappear, right? And these are things that are exacerbated by the policy choices that we've made about how we want to classify gig work and how we want to structure its opportunities for long-term growth. One of the things that comes out of Alex's story is that she doesn't really see possibilities for long-term economic development in this work, right? And it's designed not to be a pathway to long-term economic development. It's very much subject to the whims of the platform. Things can change at any moment. Things can change in ways that result in contractors having less economic stability. Again, all those are a function of ways that we've decided to classify and structure gig work. So probably a longer answer than you wanted, but all that is just to say that for readers who are interested in seeing more about how these issues impact real life people, one of the things that I liked a lot about gray areas was that it gave me a chance to dig into that from people like Alex to people like Constance, who's the chemical engineer that I profile, to Max, who's the emergency medicine doctor, to Darren, who is the financial executive. And they all are experiencing these gray areas in different ways, but their stories really highlight how much they matter in terms of shaping their workplace experiences and how they connect to the larger political and economic structures that we live in.
Thank you so much. That's a great place for us to finish on. Professor Wingfield, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a great conversation.
Adia Harvey Wingfield is the Mary Tileston Hemingway Professor of Arts and Sciences and Vice Dean for Faculty Development and Diversity at Washington University in St. Louis. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Adia Harvey Wingfield for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It really helps other people to find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.